The next case of the morning is number 051045, the United States against Jamison.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Anthony Delier, and I represent Shondell Jamison. The case before the Court today is a little bit unusual in that, in this case, the government realized that in one of the counts, it could not meet its burden of beyond a reasonable doubt, which it believed was the law at the time that this case was pled out. That fact is important in this case. But the case isn't going to turn on the facts. This case is going to turn on an application of the law, because there are three possible maximum sentences that could apply in this case. There's the pre-Blakely mandatory guidelines, wherein there was judicial fact-finding by preponderance and the mandatory guidelines. There's the post-Blakely mandatory guidelines, where the jury or the defendant had to make an admission or a finding of fact. And finally, there is the post-Booker advisory guidelines, wherein there is judicial fact-finding by a preponderance standard, but the guidelines are advisory. This is the key critical fact, because if the first of the possibilities is used, Mr. Jamison could have only been sentenced to a maximum of 37 months. If the second one were used, it would be 41 months. And if the third one were used, he could theoretically have been sentenced to 240 months. This change in the possible maximum sentence invokes the ex post facto clause. We have argued in our briefs that there is no doubt that he could not be sentenced under the first of these three sentencing schemes, because it was found by the United States Supreme Court to be unlawful as a violation of his Sixth Amendment rights. We have argued in our brief that he could not be sentenced under the third one because of the ex post facto clause. In theory, the sentencing court could have sentenced him up to 240 months rather than the 37 months of exposure that he had. The court in this case will rest upon this court's decision on one fact or one conclusion of law.
Why doesn't he get the first crack at it?
Excuse me?
Why doesn't he get the first crack at it?
The first crack
at it? The trial judge on his sentencing. Why doesn't he exercise one of those options, two of which you say?
Well, the first option wasn't possible because of the Blakely
case. I understand that.
And the third option is not possible because of the ex post facto clause.
Then why are we here?
We are here because had he been sentenced under the second option, the only one that we believe is legal, the judge would have been required to sentence Mr. Jamison for the facts that were admitted at his
What's the status of the case immediately as we sit here now?
The status of the case is that Mr. Jamison was found guilty and sent to prison.
Yes.
And he has approximately...
And everybody agrees it has to go back down. Am I correct in that analysis?
I don't believe that that's true, Your Honor.
Then you proceed. I'm in error.
Thank you, sir. This is one of the few times in my short legal career where I felt like I knew exactly what I was talking about on one issue of law, and that is, what was the maximum sentence at the time that Shondell Jamison pled guilty in this case? At that time, Blakely had been decided, Booker had not, and there was a string of cases, Jones, Apprendi, Ring, Blakely, and they all said the maximum sentence is the sentence that a judge can impose based upon what the defendant pled guilty to and admitted or a jury found. That is the only maximum sentence that would be allowed under 2, which is the post-Blakely, pre-Booker period of time in which Mr. Jamison pled guilty and was sentenced. If we were to allow the maximum sentence from the post-Booker advisory guidelines, Mr. Jamison could receive a sentence of 240 months. Clearly, that's a substantial change in the law, not just a procedural one. And it does invoke the ex post facto clause of the Constitution as well as due process. And I'd like to just briefly talk about that. We are talking about the Constitution here. And the government has argued, and I think that they can make this argument in good faith, that Rogers is a case that this court should look to make a decision. But Rogers talks about two things, whether it was unexpected and whether it was indefensible. Okay, as far as being unexpected, I actually filed a motion in the district court. It's docket number 45. And the magistrate talked in his reply, says that the court's jury-rigged foray into sentencing trials is unfair because counsel cannot possibly provide effective assistance. That was in response to my remarks. And he later went on to talk about how I was basically living in Wonderland because we had a process set up where we would be able to have jury findings of fact. But as it turns out, that wasn't what the law ended up being. So I didn't know then, the magistrate judge that was operating in this case did not know then what the law would be. So it was clearly unexpected, and it was clearly indefensible. I believed at that time that I was ineffective as counsel because I did not know what the rules were for my client. I couldn't even tell him what a sentencing hearing might look like. So then the government also relies on Duncan, and again, they can do this in good faith. But the questions are, was there an error? Was the error plain? Did it affect substantial rights? And does it affect the fairness and integrity of the court? If the definition of the maximum sentence at the time that Mr. Jamison pled guilty was that of the Blakely-Eyes guidelines, then in fact, this is a violation of the ex post facto clause. So there was an error. The error was plain. It affected a substantial right, in fact, a constitutional right, and it clearly would impinge upon the integrity of this court. Finally, it's the government's burden to show beyond a reasonable doubt that the error was harmless. And the government cannot possibly meet its burden in this case because both the guideline sentence and the discretionary sentence imposed violate both the due process and the ex post facto clause of the Constitution. I rely on Chapman, as I did earlier in my briefs. Constitutional error, the burden befalls the government as the beneficiary of the constitutional error to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error complained of did not contribute to the verdict obtained or, in this case, the sentence. I don't understand how they could possibly meet this burden when the maximum sentence was changed by the definition of a maximum sentence being changed through the judicial process. And that's something that was addressed by the Rogers Court as well. And finally, I just would like to leave the court with a thought that I had as I was sitting here today. If we can send somebody to jail or prison when they didn't understand the law at the time, then, and we can convict them and send them to prison, and they have no defense because of their lack of knowledge of the law, then the government should not be able to come here today and argue that Mr. Jamison's possible knowledge of the law is also not a defense. Surely, either lack of knowledge of the law or knowledge of the law has to be a defense. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Meredith Dushman, and I represent the appellee of the United States. There are two issues in this case. The first is whether the ex post facto and due process clauses of the United States Constitution prohibit application of the second part of the Supreme Court's decision in United States versus Booker. The second issue
is argument, as you see it, is that they are unable to use the guidelines even as an advisory thing.
No, Your Honor. And actually, in this case,
I'm confused because I'm not sure how he raises the issue of
exactly.
Double jeopardy.
And that's one thing, if I may. I think the way the entire issue is framed is convoluted, and I want to talk a little bit about that, if I may.
I'm glad you told me that. I thought I had lost my marbles.
Let me just briefly mention that the second issue is whether or not the The defendant's sentence was reasonable. The United States is actually the party that raised the issue to begin with, and actually the defendant doesn't contest that his sentence was unreasonable. It was unreasonable, so I won't focus on the reasonableness. I'll focus on this ex post facto issue. I think part of the reason that Your Honor's confused is that the underlying premise of this entire argument is flawed. In order to have an ex post facto problem slash due process problem to begin with, you have to have retroactive application of something, either a new law by a legislature or a new interpretation of a law by a court. And here what defendant is doing is making a general claim that the retroactive application of Justice Breyer's remedial opinion in Booker is unconstitutional. But the fact of the matter is, defendant's case doesn't involve the retroactive application of the remedial opinion in Booker. It doesn't involve the application of the Supreme Court's opinion in Booker at all, because the defendant was sentenced before the United States Supreme Court actually issued its opinion in Booker. And so this entire ex post facto issue is raised purely in the hypothetical. It's created in the abstract for the purposes of appeal rather than an issue that actually applies to this particular defendant. And of course, the purpose of creating this ex post facto issue is simply to get a Blakeleyized sentence. The defendant wants a Blakeleyized sentence. All defendants want Blakeleyized sentences. The defendant basically wants you to order the district court to resentence him, applying the first part of the Booker opinion, but not the second part, because you can't apply that because of ex post facto and due process. Now, the defendant isn't really the first person to try this sort of shotgun approach. As I mentioned in my brief, two courts have already dealt with this issue, and both have rejected the defendant's position. We've got the 11th Circuit in Duncan and the Southern District of West Virginia in Gray. This is not in my brief, but just this Tuesday, so 2 days ago, the 5th Circuit also came out with a decision rejecting defendant's position. I will be submitting a 28J on that for the court's consideration. So the courts that have sort of dealt with this issue have rejected defendant's position, and rightfully so, because the mandate of the Supreme Court was clear. We're not going to have Blakeleyized guidelines going forward, and both portions of the Booker opinion will apply to all cases on direct review, and that would include Mr. Jameson's. And the second main point I want to make here is that the case law makes clear that the key principle in any kind of an ex post facto due process analysis is fair notice. And that inquiry focuses on what the law was at the time the defendant engaged in the conduct. When defendant sold drugs to a confidential informant on June 21st, 2004, which was the count he was subsequently convicted on, unlike the defendants in Bowie and unlike the defendants in Marks, here we have a federal criminal statute, 21 United States Code Section 841A1, that clearly made his conduct illegal and that unambiguously designated his maximum penalty for that conduct as 20 years.
Now, that was not affected by Booker, right? These statutory maximums?
I don't believe it was, no.
We're dealing only with the guidelines. And we always said in these cases where, I suppose, under Apprendi, that where these enhancements were, we'd always say, yeah, but it's less than the statutory maximum.
Right, and I think, you know, at arraignment, defendants are always notified of the statutory maximum, and I think you're absolutely right.
Well, now what he's claiming is that, I guess what you're saying, 37 months, I guess, would be the highest under the guidelines with the facts proven.
That's correct.
With now the guidelines are advisory. So
correct.
I guess, theoretically, this sentence, I guess the court could have said, this is way too low, this guy deserves the maximum or something. Theoretically, they could go to the statutory maximum. Is that correct?
That's correct. Theoretically, yes. I think what's key is to look at what the defendant knew at the time of his conduct my conduct is illegal, maximum penalty is 20 years. You look at what he was ultimately subjected to at sentencing, maximum penalty of 20 years. Here you've got sort of an odd posture in the sense that this sentencing occurred post-Blakely and post this court's decision in Booker, and so the district court, perhaps foreseeing very well what the Supreme Court was going to do, found that he couldn't apply the mandatory guidelines constitutionally. So what he did is he used the guidelines as a guide, and then he used his discretion to impose a sentence up to the statutory maximum of 20 years. Bottom line, 20 years at the time of sentence, maximum penalty, 20 years at the time he handed drugs over to the confidential informant. Now, it's true that after Blakely came out and after this court's decision in Booker, this defendant was hoping for a windfall. All defendants were hoping for some kind of windfall, but that just frankly didn't happen. But this judicial confusion during the pendency of the defendant's case isn't an ex post facto problem. And I don't believe it's a due process problem either. And for those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm the sentence.
Thank you, counsel. You have two more minutes, sir.
Let me see if I can clarify this a little bit. The question is, what was the maximum sentence? There were three possible times that we could talk about. We could talk about the guidelines as they were up until Blakely. We can talk about the guidelines from Blakely to Booker and the post-Booker guidelines. Three different possible sentences. Okay, there were also three different possible maximum sentences. And the change in the maximum sentence went from 30-some months to 240 months because the Supreme Court made a decision in the law. All I'm asking this court to do is to look to the cases that the government cites. And when you look at those cases, read them carefully and note that in each of those, they say that the maximum sentence was the statutory maximum. If that is true, and if that is what this court believes, then the government should prevail. On the other hand, if the United States Supreme Court's opinion in Booker, in which they talked about their decisions about what exactly is a maximum sentence through Ring, Apprendi, Jones, etc., if they were correct when they said the maximum sentence was the maximum sentence that a judge could impose under the facts found by a jury or admitted to, and this is during the time that Mr. Jameson entered his plea, if the Supreme Court is correct, then Mr. Jameson must prevail. And that is the only question of law that I put before this court today. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Delier, you served by appointment of the court in this case, and you have the thanks of the court for your fine efforts on behalf of your client. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.